Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Dave Marshall and today I ventured 5 doors down from my PhD room at the University of Bristol to the office of Professor Mike Benton. It might sound a bit like pretty lazy journalism, but Professor Benton is a world-renowned paleontologist and one of our most requested interviewees. He's really got the perfect voice for radio and a brilliant presentation style, so it's a mystery why it's taken us so long to interview him. But before we get to that, we've got to get through our admin. Firstly, I'm pleased to announce that our virtual Natural History Museum project has finally been funded. A massive thank you to the Paleontological Association for their amazing support, and another massive thank you to everyone who donated to our crowdfunding campaign. This great educational project simply couldn't have happened without your contributions, so thanks again, and we'll keep you all informed as the project develops. Secondly, if you've been looking forward to our live stream of progressive paleontology from the Oxford University Museum of Natural History, we're sorry that we weren't able to bring that to you. The internet speed just wasn't high enough in the museum, but we did make recordings of the event and we'll make all of those available to you soon. And finally, the annual podcast awards. After a review period, PaleoCast qualified as a top 10 finalist in the education category for the second year running. So we can proudly say again that we're one of the top 10 educational podcasts in the world. So thank you to everyone who nominated us. So voting is now underway for deciding the winner. If you head over to podcastawards.com, you can vote us as your favourite podcast in the education category. Daily voting begins on the 29th of May and runs for 15 days. You're allowed to vote once every day. So if you like the show, please make sure you get those votes in. We're up against some stiff competition and some past winners, but let's make this a year for paleontology. If you're a first-time listener, having found us via the Podcast Awards, welcome, it's great to have you here. Every episode of PaleoCast, we interview someone about their work in the field of paleontology. It's an absolutely massive subject which incorporates elements of geology, biology, chemistry, physics, history, art, you name it. We have around 4 billion years worth of evolution to discuss. But today's interview with Professor Mike Benton focuses on the time when life nearly died. As always, pictures supporting this episode are available on our website, and please like and share this episode on social media. I hope you enjoy the show. Thanks for joining us, Mike.
Yeah, pleasure.
We always like to start off with getting to know our interviewee a little bit better. So can you tell us about your journey to becoming professor?
Well, I think like with most people, it was never the target. What I wanted to do was to work in paleontology, and that was it. And I had no idea when, I think I probably decided this at the age of 7, like so many people. And then I didn't have exactly a practical idea of how the world worked, but I knew somehow or other it would happen. It could have been a museum, could have been university, but I enjoy university because, of course, you get to teach. And that's a huge pleasure because all the bright young people coming up all the time with great new ideas. And it keeps you on your toes because you have to keep reading and thinking and make sure you're up to date with stuff. So I did my PhD at the University of Newcastle, got my first post was actually not an academic job. It was working for the Nature Conservancy Council, as it then was. And my job in a year was to identify and write up the scientific justifications for the sites of special scientific interest, SSSIs, for fossil reptiles, of which there are 50. So those are all the key dinosaur sites in the UK, that kind of thing. And that was great fun. I got to drive around everywhere up to Egg and round all the classic Mantell and Owen and localities and so on. Postdoc in Oxford, because I happened to be near there when I was working for the NCC, and then got my first job in Belfast, 5 years there, and then Bristol. And I've been here ever since 1989.
Wow. you've written a few books in your career thus far. But one that really stands out to me is The Fossil Record 2. Can you explain to us the concept of this book?
Yes. Yeah, so nowadays you wouldn't do it as a book, you'd do it as a website. But back then, 20 years ago or more, it seemed obvious that a book was needed. So the Geological Society of London had done a book in 1967 called The Fossil Record. And that was the first ever summary of what knowledge of the distribution in time of different fossil groups. Sadly, that wasn't made a great deal of effort, or what could I say? That didn't lead to a revolution in paleontology at the time in a way that was taken on by David Raup and Jack Sepkoski in Chicago. And they made the running, and Sepkoski made his own databases, which were subsequently published as books. So The Fossil Record 2 came along as an idea, rather than one person doing the whole job, which is what Jack Sepkoski did miraculously. My idea was to recruit 100 people who would cover each group. And secondly, it was to be as cladistic as possible. So at that time, that was quite a challenge, because people were not generating cladistic analyses except for vertebrates and some plant groups. So we had to push quite hard to do that. So yes, it was a huge task. I didn't write very much of it myself. It was mainly editing and corralling these 100 authors. And some of them I had to sack in the end, because they just proved impossible, and write the blasted chapters myself. So I had to get into mollusks and strange Cambrian organisms just to get the blasted thing done.
But it's basically a book that shows the age range of every fossil group, isn't it?
That's correct. And so unlike the 1967 one, it was all down to family level, and we didn't miss anything out. So microfossils were there, and plants, and everything pretty much. And it was quite problematic for some groups, but supposedly complete. And then we could use it for synoptic calculations of diversity through time and stuff like that.
I mean, even if you didn't write the whole thing yourself, having to arrange the whole book to be written and know if there's anything that missing must have been quite an undertaking.
Yes, it's 845 A4 pages, closely printed, and every item of data there, the thousands of bits of data needed checking. The main issue, though, as an editor, is just knocking your authors into shape. And a small number were very well behaved and delivered their chapters on time. A middling group, after a lot of prodding and cajoling, eventually came up with their chapters. And so it was about a year late, which I feel sorry about, because, you know, the good authors then were suffering in a sense. And then we had to make some hard decisions at the end about those people who in the end didn't turn in the goods.
So will there be a Fossil Record 3?
No, certainly not. Certainly not. I don't think anybody would do it. I wouldn't do it. But subsequently, the internet has overtaken book-like productions, things like the Paleobiology Database, obviously. It doesn't quite do exactly what the Fossil Record 2 did, but it's a much more comprehensive resource. So I don't think you could even begin to compete with that.
Another book you've written was entitled When Life Nearly Died, and life's recovery from the Permo-Triassic mass extinction is going to be the subject of this interview. So how did you get interested in the details of this event?
I think I was always interested in the Triassic. So the subject of my PhD were Triassic rhynchosaurs, an unusual group of herbivores. And early on during my PhD, I also got interested in the origin of dinosaurs. So the first dinosaurs at that time were thought to be late Triassic. Perhaps now the first dinosaurs are somewhat earlier. But nonetheless, it got me interested in macroevolution in a broad sense, because there were different ideas then about how did the dinosaurs originate. And I noted that a lot of the writing by paleontologists, it's very hard to think back 30 years how poor quality a lot of the reasoning and documentation was. And I got interested then in questions of getting the stratigraphy right, because people were often quite sloppy then. They'd just say, oh, it's middle Triassic. And you say, well, that's not good enough. You know, you can tell us closer than that. And if you're trying to look at evolution, like rates of change and events, you have to have much more precise division of time. And I was also interested in cladistics. This was the early 80s, and lots of people were beginning to do the first cladograms of major groups. And it became obvious that those two could be combined to give you the base data for macroevolutionary study. And the older generation, whose books I read and papers I read, just said, oh, the dinosaurs replaced the Paleozoic type reptiles because they were in various ways superior. Mm-hmm. They had bigger teeth or longer legs. And I remember thinking, that's maybe true, but it's a very, what's the evidence? You know, it's a very sloppy way of looking at it. And then an opportunity came up in the early 90s to go to Russia. And this was shortly after the Soviet Union collapsed. And the Royal Society and various other funding agencies were really then looking at Russia in a very generous fashion. And they could see that the scientists in Russia were not getting their salaries, they were not being paid, it was not working well. And so we bid for some funding to look at the Permo-Triassic in total in Russia, working with people in Moscow and Saratov and other places. And so I went to Russia for the first time in 93. We were taken out in the field, and I remember bouncing around in the back of this Soviet Jeep type of thing. Professor Valentin Tverdoklebov, who was leading the trip, he was a geological mapper. He'd been mapping for his whole life, knew every inch of the ground. This was on the banks of the River Ural near Orenburg. And we're just bouncing along in this thing, feeling a little bit queasy, and he was just describing stuff in Russian, which was being translated to us by a student of his. By the way, this is the Permo-Triassic boundary. Let's go on and look at something else. And I said, stop. How do you know? What's the evidence? Because none of the work that Tverdoklebov had done on the geology of this area had ever been published, because it was all done for the Geological Survey and was top secret. And of course, Permo-Triassic boundary, yeah, you want to know. And so we were querying him, yeah, of course it is. We have magnetostratigraphic evidence. Show us. No, top secret. Oh, we have palynological evidence and microfossil evidence of other kinds. Where is it published? What are the species? Can we compare them with the German sequence or the North American or Chinese sequences? Oh, no, none of this, you know, this is all top secret stuff. So it was quite frustrating, but that got us going on a big research project on the PT boundary in Russia. And over the course of maybe 10 or 15 years, going back time after time, we were able to, with the Russians, publish a whole series of papers about that stuff. So it was that kind of classic integrated fieldwork that got me interested. And luckily, Tverdoklebov had kept an incredibly detailed card catalogue of all the fossil vertebrates that they had ever found, and over his 50-year career. So this was a fantastic resource. And so we finally persuaded him that this could be published without major threat to Russian security. and he agreed. And so we published a couple of lengthy papers that gave an enormous catalogue of all the localities and the fossils and the evidence for the age of all these formations, which, you know, being Westerners, at first we could be quite patronizing and think, oh, well, it's not been published, you know, they don't really know what's going on. And the more we looked at it, the more we realized, of course, we were wrong. They had spent an immense amount of time and had done the job properly. But getting it published was essential, of course. And then we were able to derive from that a quite detailed model of ecosystem change across the PT boundary based on this very intensive sampling in Russia, which had been kind of just nowhere. It hadn't been in the literature at all.
So is Russia a particularly rich in rocks from this age, or is it just that the country's so vast that you're bound to come across some Permo-Triassic rocks?
It's a bit of both. It is a vast land, of course. So unlike China, there's just so much to be found out because of that vastness in both places. So when I started, the only type exemplar we had of vertebrate evolution across the PT boundary was, of course, the Karoo in South Africa. So we hope by our work and other people's work, we've brought the Russian succession out into the open. And there's so much more to do because, as I mentioned, people had done all this mapping, but it's still not been published. And so it needs continuing major effort. And there are big commercial drivers now which will eventually break through, because beneath this red bed succession are the vast gas and oil reserves that are fueling the Russian economy at the moment. So I suppose that added to the interest. You know, we wanted to look at boreholes and mysteriously they were lost. And I can think even now in a more open world, nonetheless, the Russians will be quite protective of their important gas reserves. But there will be growing pressure, I'm sure, so that there'll be a program of drilling and other activity that will help.
Well, before we get into too many details, I think it'll be just wise to put us in the context of what the Permian period was like before this mass extinction. So if we were to just transport ourselves back in time now, what would things look like? Are the ecosystems comparable to modern ones?
I think if you went back to the late Permian, either in the oceans or on land, they look very, very different. And I think you have to, in the oceans, you have to think of rugose and tabulate corals, trilobites, brachiopods as being the main seabed shellfish. Bivalves and gastropods are present, but quite rare or less significant. And the reefs, and as we know from North America and other parts of the world and from China, were very substantial. So the scene in the oceans, at least in various parts of the world, was very busy, hundreds of species, quite a complex and seemingly stable kind of ecosystem, and with a great deal of endemism, so different cohorts of species in different parts of the world. And it seems to be similar on land, although we have fewer places that we can sample. But in Russia and South Africa, and now a little bit of evidence from China, there was a great diversity of amphibians and reptiles. And I think the ecosystems had got, by the end of the Permian, to their most, on land at least, they'd got to their most complex, in the sense that there were extra trophic levels at the top that hadn't existed in the early Permian or Carboniferous. So to put it in context, at the very end of the Permian, you had all the smaller creatures and fish eaters, insect eaters, little things preying on other small animals and so on. But at the top of the food chain, everywhere you look, were giant or relatively large herbivores called pariasaurs, which were great hulking creatures with tiny heads and a bit warty. And they have been called the ugliest creatures ever, but who can say? And some of those were about the size of a hippopotamus. And then there were specialists, the very first specialist saber-toothed predators. So this is evidence, if you like, for this kind of top trophic level, which had lengthy teeth, and they were clearly preying upon the thick-skinned herbivores. So there was no sign either in the oceans or on land of any kind of downturn or difficult situation. There had been an extinction event at the end of the Guadalupean, maybe 7 or 8 million years before the end of the Permian, but life that was modest, and life recovered from that. So at the end of the Permian, there didn't seem to be any sign that trouble was threatening.
So let's get to the extinction then. We've already covered mass extinctions in episode 23 with Professor Paul Wignall. So if you want to learn more about what they are and how they're measured, and plus hear an overview of the end Permian and the end Cretaceous mass extinctions, then head there first. But for the rest of us, can you give us a summary of the Permo-Triassic mass extinction?
I think that there's a fairly agreed model for the extinction, which has been more or less the leading view for 20 years now. And that is, it's all down to the eruption of the Siberian Traps, the great basalt volcanic rocks in Siberia, eastern Russia. There were some alternative views, such as that maybe it was triggered by the coming together of the continents into Pangaea, which would somehow reduce the diversity of life by bringing together all the different faunas. That's been rejected because it just wouldn't be catastrophic enough. A catastrophic alternative hypothesis was that the Earth was hit by a meteorite, and there was a small amount of evidence for that when it was presented, but that hasn't been corroborated, and in fact, much of that evidence was rejected. So I think for the moment, we would have to say evidence of impact is very limited. And that is a massive contrast, of course, with the end Cretaceous. So this is not a kind of old-fashioned view. This is an evidence-based view. And so the eruption of the Siberian Traps, the sequence of events for which there is evidence is the eruptions began before the Permo-Triassic extinction, and they carried on sometime after, happening in pulses. And there must have been one or two in the middle of the time of eruption that were particularly intensive. And each time the eruptions happened, it's not so much the bubbling basalt lava, which then flowed out laterally and made great stratified stacks of lava covering a gigantic area. But it was more the gases that people focus on, and particularly carbon dioxide, which had two effects. It produced acid rain on land, and it produced global warming. And both of those effects would likely kill life on land. And there is evidence for the acid rain in that there is massive killing off of forests. So all trees disappear at that point, and you don't get trees back. There's a so-called coal gap. There's no coal and no trees for maybe 10 million years into the Triassic. And secondly, when you look at sedimentary systems across the boundary, and we noted this in Russia, across the PT boundary, there's a huge shift in the style of sedimentation from meandering streams and lakes in the latest Permian to braided streams, much higher energy, combined with really striking breccias right at the boundary. And this has been noted independently in South Africa, in Spain, in certain other places where you can track the PT boundary closely. And we argued that this was evidence of a massive wash-off from the Ural Mountains, bringing down great boulders, enabled by the removal of trees. It's a classic deforestation kind of phenomenon. And that was confirmed unexpectedly by a couple of studies of marginal marine sediments, which showed an influx of terrestrially derived organic matter of an unprecedented amount at the boundary, and an influx of effectively sand. So terrestrially derived sand, there's a great spike again at the boundary. Now in the sea, the global warming would have perhaps had the main effect of driving down thermoclines and stagnating the oceans to a considerable extent. And there's primary evidence of that. Nearly everywhere you look at marine sections, you go from oxygenated sediments, often limestones, bioclastic, full of evidence of life, burrows, et cetera, et cetera. Immediately above the boundary, the sediment switches often to mudstone. Importantly, it's black. It often contains pyrite. These are all indicators of anoxia. It contains very few fossils, no burrows. You know, all of the sort of evidence of life has kind of gone. So those are the main killing phenomena. And then it would have taken maybe a few thousand years for those conditions to kind of settle back to something like normal, and then the fast evolving species could start to re-radiate.
The Siberian Traps, you say that it was a flood basalt rather than, because if I think of a volcanic eruption, it's a big mountain blowing the top off and yes, loads of ash everywhere.
Quite.
But this was more of a bubbling, liquidy lava, yes, that spread out. How big and how far did all of this lava go?
The area is huge. It's about the size of Europe. It is absolutely vast. I can't give you that in square kilometers. Mm-hmm. And the volumes were millions of cubic kilometers of lava. And although at the time it would have been pretty terrifying, it is the bubbling flood basalt type of phenomenon of the mid-ocean ridge, or what you could see on Iceland, which doesn't look that scary. But nonetheless, per volume of lava, the volume of gases are the same as with an explosive Plinian-type eruption.
And if there was a bolide impact, an asteroid or a meteorite that came and hit the Earth, in the end Cretaceous mass extinction, we see an iridium spike, which is an element in the meteorite that is rich in the meteorite, but not rich on Earth. And so when that hit and vaporized, we had a kind of like iridium rain. Is there no evidence for that? You say there's possible evidence of mm-hmm. an impact. Are we talking a crater, or are we talking something elemental like iridium?
So for the KT, for the end Cretaceous mass extinction, initially there was no crater. And a lot of people said, oh, well, there wasn't an impact. But of course, you don't need to have a crater, as you say. The iridium spike is a pretty good indicator. And if the impact is big enough, as it was at the end of the Cretaceous, that iridium dust and rain will go all around the Earth. And it doesn't necessarily help you to find the crater. But the point is, for the PT boundary, there is no iridium spike. It was suggested, but people have said, no, you know, when it was re-measured, people couldn't replicate the result. There was a crater suggested offshore from Australia based on geophysical readings, but crater experts had a look at the geophysical data and said, no, this isn't a crater, it's more of a trench. And so the structure wasn't the right shape and was due to a fault or some other normal process. And they also reported some shocked quartz. That's another of these indicators of high pressure. But again, the people who'd looked at the end Cretaceous example said, no, this is could be volcanic. It's not definitively impact. So all the pieces, you know, there's a shopping list of maybe 10 or 15 phenomena that people identify at the end of the Cretaceous, including a crater, all of which point to impact. And none of that shopping list has really been identified at the end of the Permian.
The Permian extinction, was that just the single event then? You mentioned before that in the mid-Permian, in the Guadalupean, there was another extinction event. So should we be looking at the Permo-Triassic as one single event, bam, it happened and killed everything, or more of a sequential series of things that like first took life to its knees and then...
Yeah, and that's a question that people are have really sharpened up their views of in the last 10 years. So when I started to be interested in this in the early 90s, the quality of available stratigraphy, particularly radiometric dating, was pretty poor. And people often conflated the end Guadalupean and end Permian events as if they were one. And if you were looking in time bins of 10 million years, you could lose them both. But now there's no question that there was an extinction event at the end of the Middle Permian, but it was not profound and life recovered. And that was 7 or 8 million years before the end of the Permian, and therefore you can't connect them. It doesn't sound like much to us, but biologically speaking, that's a hugely long span of time. And but interestingly, there are two pieces of evidence now that seem fairly clear of multiple events. Not the end Guadalupean, but now the radiometric dating in the Chinese sections across the Permo-Triassic boundary is so good that they can point to two pulses of extinction, one just below the Permo-Triassic boundary and one just above. And those two have been identified for a while, and people have been dating on both sides. And now, currently, that these two events are suggested to be spaced apart by only 60,000 years. So the quality, the precision of the dating is such that they can say 60,000 years. And between those two pulses of extinction in the Chinese section, you can see the origination and extinction of a number of species, and then the second extinction pulse comes. So the first one was it killed off something like 90% of species in the Chinese section. Some recovery took place in a small way. And then the second pulse killed off another 20 or 30%, but there wasn't much left. So it's hard to scale them. The second one could have been as serious, but you know, there wasn't much left there. So in total, they seem to have wiped out something more than 90%, maybe even 95%. So this is really, as people have called it, the nearest to complete disappearance of life, or when life nearly died, the title of this program. And then the second multiple event thing, which we'll come on to, was that there were further pulses of extinction, it seems, through the early Triassic as well.
So 90 to 95% of life, that is an amazingly high amount. Was it simply that we lost 90 to 95% of groups, or within each group we lost 90 to 95% of individuals and the group survived?
So there were some major groups disappeared completely. So, for example, in the oceans, all the corals, the rugose corals, the tabulate corals, the trilobites, although maybe they were somewhat diminished in numbers, the graptolites. So a lot of the classic Paleozoic groups that people know and love, well known through the whole of the Paleozoic, they finally disappeared at that point. And on land, there were a whole group of amphibians and reptiles and other groups that also were totally terminated. But as you hint, a lot of other groups survived. So for example, brachiopods survived, although many of the key orders of brachiopods disappeared, bivalves and gastropods and various kinds of arthropods, the sort of crabs and lobsters. And amongst fishes in the oceans, as far as we can tell, a lot of the sharks and the bony fishes survived, although individual families and orders disappeared. So it was a kind of mixed event. And it's not as easy to describe to people as the end Cretaceous, because the groups are not as familiar as ammonites and dinosaurs, but they were just as many major dominant ecological groups as that actually were killed off. But the point was, even amongst the surviving groups, they were not surviving in glory. They were massively depleted.
How are we able to quantify this? Do we simply look at the fossil record before, the fossil record after, and then subtract one from the other?
It's a very mixed question, because I think there's not a single answer to this business of how do you calculate the magnitude of an extinction event, although it's the most obvious question. And the reason I hedge a little bit, of course, is you can try to answer it at the global scale, or you can try to answer it at the local scale. Global scale is of great interest because we clearly want to know. But of course, we need to remember underneath the global scale of an event is the fact that within each region of the Earth, there may be endemic fauna. So you can have a total figure, but you need to look at this finer granularity to understand, is it equally substantial at the equators or at the poles or northern hemisphere, southern hemisphere? So the interesting thing that happened was, when people did the first calculations, people like Raup and Sapkowski, based upon their global databases, they were coming up with figures of maybe 90% of species. But there were criticisms of that for two reasons, because in doing a global calculation, often your time scale is not very precise, because unless you have wonderful correlation, you have to then generalize and do it by the whole of the late Permian or stages, which may be 4 or 5 million years long. And people can say, oh, well, are you sure that the Russian fossils are the same age as those ones? And the other difficulty is you can't really do it at species level when you're doing a global scale study, because the incompleteness of the rock and fossil records means that at species level, you've got no idea whether your global counts are anywhere close to reality. You might be a little bit more confident of the counts of genera, maybe a little more confident of the counts of families. You know, as you go up to higher levels in the taxonomic hierarchy, you can be a wee bit more confident, because you only need to find one species of whatever to know you've got the family, but there might be 100 species that you're missing. So the way Raup and Sapkowski got to 90 or 95% was they found that 50% of families died out and people were reasonably confident about that figure. But then they did what Raup called reverse rarefaction, which is a lot fancier than what it is. That is simply based on an assumption that if you lose one family, you've had to kill every species in that family. Mm-hmm. If there's an average of 50 species per family of marine organisms, you can estimate that to kill off 50% of families completely, you're going to be depleting the other 50% substantially. And you can put a figure on that amount of depletion of the surviving families. And that's how he got to that figure, going from 50% of families to 95% of species. But that was criticized because people were commenting, well, you can't have a single risk figure because some species are more at risk than others. So some scaled that back to maybe 80%. However, it was very interesting when finally detailed work was done on the wonderful sections in China, where there's very full sections, very little rock missing, it seems, and you can track, centimeter by centimeter. There you can count the species because you're just looking at a single site and there's less argument, and you can say, well, within this section, this is the pattern of species through time. And there, lo and behold, they came up with this 90% figure as well. So for most people, I think that was seen as interesting confirmation. It still doesn't completely answer that scaling effect of this is happening in China, maybe this is happening in Greenland, maybe this is happening in Canada. They're different species. You've got the endemism thing, and how do you sum that up through the regions up to the global scale? However you do it, though, applying these methods to the PT extinction versus any of the others, it's always much more serious. It's always, relatively speaking, a different order of magnitude from the end Cretaceous and all the other mass extinctions.
So if we have a look now at which groups survived, are there any patterns?
People have asked this question of, is there any selectivity? Could we say, for example, that big animals and plants died off, or deep sea organisms or larval breeding organisms? And it's proved quite difficult to find clear evidence of selectivity that really works substantially. Yes, on land, certainly the larger organisms did die out, but then they're more at risk because they're at smaller population size. So it's a slightly more complex comparison than simply saying what happened, what is the guiding character of survivors and victims. So I think people have found, so of the survivors, there were various groups of amphibians and reptiles, which eventually gave rise to dinosaurs and mammals and frogs and all the rest. And in the oceans, bony fishes and sharks survived and gave rise to some modern groups in the Triassic. The bivalves, gastropods, and ammonoids survived, the mollusks, and they all radiated quite well. The brachiopods did survive, but they were substantially knocked, and they never seemed to recover. So they just carried on pottering at low levels through to the present day. So there are some differentials, and there were winners and losers, definitely. And it is a truism to say that the effect of the substantial weeding out of species that took place and killing off of major groups, or hitting them so hard, like the brachiopods, that they never recovered, shaped the modern world. So the key groups in the oceans track back, and the key groups on land track back to the Triassic pretty well.
You mentioned before about endemism. Do we see any kind of like refugia of certain groups? Is there like a little place where all the brachiopods survived, or a place where the reptiles did particularly well?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. And there's, yes, refugia, maybe. There were some localities in Oman which were on the margins of Pangaea that don't show the anoxic black mudstones that you see everywhere else. So it's been suggested. I mean, normally people don't find the refugia. You just have to assume they were there because species seem to disappear and then miraculously somehow or other they reemerge. But maybe these localities in Oman somehow or other escaped the global anoxia. So almost certainly that must be true, because when you look at the Chinese succession, you go from 100 species in every bed before the boundary down to 3. And yet, once you get up into the early Triassic, you're finding other groups have survived. So I think in the very earliest Triassic in China, there aren't any echinoderms, but they survived, and crinoids and echinoids and so on come back. So yeah, that's true. And the endemism thing is interesting, because one of the markers of a mass extinction is often you get a switch from that kind of regional faunas to cosmopolitan, meaning worldwide. And so in the earliest Triassic, you do get cosmopolitan faunas everywhere, both on land and in the sea. So on land, Lystrosaurus, a very famous 1-meter-long sort of bumbling little herbivore, seemed to survive. And whereas it was only known in South Africa after the event, it's found everywhere. Russia, China, South America, etc. And in the oceans, there's a very famous bivalve called Claraia, a very thin-shelled creature. And it's suddenly just found everywhere. And so there's a kind of boringness of faunas after the event, where they cease being endemic and rich and become cosmopolitan and depleted.
Looking now after the extinction event, if we consider ourselves one of the lucky 10% or 5% of groups that survived, we've made it into the Triassic. What does the world look like now?
Yeah, at the beginning of the Triassic, then we have to realize that there's a famous stratigraphic phenomenon, or three, in fact, the so-called Coal Gap, Coral Gap, and Chert Gap, the three C's. So in the deepest oceans, suddenly there's an absence of chert, which has something to do with the chemistry of the oceans. In the shallow waters, there are no reefs. The corals have gone. And on land, there's no coal formation, meaning no forests. And in all cases, it took something like 7 to 10 million years for those to reestablish. And particularly the absence of forests and the absence of reefs must have been unique in the history of the Earth, I think. Other extinction events were not so profound that they actually drove out a major, major kind of biodiverse system that was biologically based. And so that must have affected the way life could recover, because if you don't have reefs and forests, respectively, you can't have that kind of rich fauna and flora of other organisms that live within and around and on. And on land, we would say, because of the erosion and such like, that the landscape must have been pretty rocky. Soils had been removed. And so, of course, it was a long process of rebuilding that kind of interaction between life and earth to get the continent clothed with vegetation. That probably happened, geologically speaking, relatively quickly, of course. But nonetheless, for the herbivores and then the carnivores, that was devastating to ecosystems. And and in the oceans, I guess it was sort of stepwise recovery from rather bland, anoxic ocean bed environments back to the more complex ones. But with the absence of reefs, that would have changed the character of warm waters for really quite a long time.
The extinction was caused by environmental effects, a global warming. So how long did this last, and how long did it take to recover?
It seems that, geologically speaking, that fizzled out, and temperatures and other world conditions, according to the isotopic evidence, recovered within a few hundred thousand years. And so those surviving organisms, some of them managed to get going again. Although nonetheless, the continuation of poor conditions meant that some of the survivors did pop their clogs shortly after. They're sometimes called dead clade walking. They did survive, but they didn't do anything with it. But what's now being discovered is people had always noted that there seemed to be something going on through the whole of the early Triassic. That's a 5 million year span. And the isotopes have shown this very clearly, that there were continued perturbations, continued flash global warming episodes, three of them through the early Triassic, each of equal magnitude to the event at the PT boundary. So that was, you know, that was shown 10 or 15 years ago, and people thought, well, blimey, that's quite something to accommodate. And there's still not a full explanation of how that could be generated with greenhouse gases, whether carbon dioxide from the eruptions repeatedly happening, or with the addition of what must be true, the addition of methane being released from frozen deep ocean resources. But nonetheless, it happened. The isotopes and the sediments show it. So what seemed to be going on through the early Triassic and into the middle Triassic, so a total span of about 6 million years, were perturbed environments that never quite recovered. And so that would have kept the landscapes on land quite rocky and delayed the recovery of larger plants and the reestablishment of soils right up to the mountaintops. I mean, this would have begun around the water sides, I suppose. And likewise in the oceans, it seems that these repeated crises again caused anoxia. So the fast evolving organisms, like in the oceans, like ammonoids and foraminifera and conodonts, all reestablished, but within a million or a million and a half years, another crisis hit. So they were wiped out again and then reestablished. So there's a sort of sequence of recovery of certain groups, but the slower evolvers, like some of the bivalves, the mollusks and fishes in the oceans, and presumably a lot of the reptiles and others on land, they just weren't getting anywhere. And it was only finally at the beginning of the Middle Triassic that you can see ecosystems getting more complex and species somehow getting more established.
Without any forests, where were the carbon sinks?
So the whole carbon cycle must have been massively affected by that. And so it must have reverted to something like an early Paleozoic system where there was virtually no carbon being locked up in terrestrial plant systems remaining buried or burning off or, you know, other, so total change in systems. And this whole terrestrialization phenomenon in the late Silurian and Devonian, in certain ways, including the carbon sinks, were rerunning themselves in a sense in the early Triassic. And it was only perhaps 15 million years into the Triassic that other plant groups had evolved the tree form and the ability to capture more carbon and move away from the waterside and regreen the Earth's surface.
With so much of life having gone extinct, do we find any vacant niches, any morpher space that animals can evolve towards, if you forgive that expression?
I think in both cases that the opportunities were huge. I don't think it's possible to pinpoint a single or easy to describe range of opportunities. They were comprehensive. And so with the loss of reefs and forests, that left a great gap. But the larger organisms, the predators, they had been particularly hard hit. But you can't necessarily re-evolve predators quite fast. But I think it's true to say across the piece in any ecosystem that survived, so many key species would have been knocked out that it would be hard for that ecosystem to rebuild in a piecemeal manner. Whereas a smaller extinction event, if you knock out half a dozen species here and there, much of the food chain remains and might be stable or robust. But here it was all being reinvented, I think. And so we see, unlike after other events, we see an extraordinary change in the organisms that took over the key roles.
Do we see any ecological roles that never got filled?
That's very hard to answer. I can't think of any examples. And certainly when you step back and look at the bigger picture, life bounced back overall in every situation to higher levels of diversity and higher levels of disparity across the piece. So maybe there was nothing in the Paleozoic that wasn't replicated and more in the Triassic.
Did any one particular group rapidly evolve to fill a whole variety of ecological roles after the extinction?
I think that the majority of groups that became important in the Triassic can trace their ancestry back into the Permian. And it's very clear that with groups like brachiopods versus bivalves, that the incumbent form, the brachiopod in this case, did in some way prevent the radiation of the bivalves. And so with the brachiopods hard hit, then the bivalves and gastropods were able to take off. But there were a great number of origins of new clades. I think the first to come in that were most striking, mainly because of their big sharp teeth, were the marine reptiles. And people have struggled for a long time to understand how this happened. And well, I was always taught this couldn't possibly have happened like this. They must have ancestors in the Permian. But nobody's found them. And I can't believe that we would miss these large, toothy marine reptiles if they were there. And so I think that is one very dramatic set of groups, the ichthyosaurs, the ancestors of the plesiosaurs. They emerged very fast, really, by the end of the early Triassic. There was already quite a diversity of them. And they got to very large size in extreme levels of toothiness. And they were dominating marine ecosystems, you know, gobbling up the fishes, and some became specialized mollusk eaters and so on. And so there is an example of a whole new portion of an ecosystem that, as far as we can tell, at best, the sharks were fulfilling this role in the Permian. And as by the middle Triassic, you already had three or four trophic levels of marine reptiles kind of adding on top, depending upon the marine ecosystem on the seabed. And maybe this was part of a trigger to force the Mesozoic marine revolution, which had already been noted, where this is all species of fishes and crabs and lobsters, and the organisms they preyed upon, a sort of arms race of increasing defenses, thicker shells, chemical defenses, and against a greater variety of predatory attack in the Mesozoic than had ever been experienced in the Paleozoic.
So if we take a step back now and look at the picture overall, how was the status quo affected from the Permian to the Triassic?
I think this was a profound event, and I think when you look at it in detail, of course, you're tracking the different groups that come and go, as we've discussed. But I think when you step back, people like Jack Sepkoski, and even all the way back to the earliest geologists and stratigraphers back in Victorian times, always noticed that somehow or other this boundary between the Paleozoic and Mesozoic was unbelievably profound in terms of the change in the organisms that you find, and much more profound than the switch between the Mesozoic and Cenozoic. And so we've already discussed the case of how the brachiopods and the crinoids and various fish groups and others in the oceans massively lost out and were totally replaced by the modern dominants, the bivalves and the gastropods, the so-called neopterygian fishes, which include the teleosts, the faster swimming, less heavily armored fish groups, the neoselachians, the modern groups of sharks. They all originate somewhere in the middle Triassic and became increasingly dominant. So in the oceans, Sepkoski made this very clear. He called the marine faunas, all the way from sponges to fishes, the modern fauna. And the modern fauna tracks back to the Triassic. So this was really critical in punctuating the history of life. And on land, it was the same thing. You might not think of dinosaurs as being part of a modern fauna, but they are, because they are birds, of course. And so you track the origins of all the modern dominant groups on land, particularly among the vertebrates. For example, the first mammals are known in the late Triassic, and the first birds, if we allow dinosaurs, also in the Triassic, maybe even in the middle Triassic. The first lizards and their relatives, the first frogs and their relatives, all track back to the middle and early Triassic. And the same is true for many plant groups and insect groups and others as well. So I think I've mentioned some of the groups that benefited to a large extent. They are the ones that we see today. And they were also punched to higher levels of diversity by events during the Mesozoic as well.
Can we learn anything from the Permo-Triassic mass extinction that we can apply to biotic crises that we're facing today?
I think it's an interesting one to look at, because although the Earth was so different, so we must be careful when we try to make predictions, because we're looking at a Pangaea without ice caps at the poles. And so both the distribution of land and sea and hence the distribution of ocean currents and the nature of temperature gradients from equator to pole, and hence the weather and all sorts of other things, were utterly different. But obviously the organisms involved were utterly different. Nonetheless, the model of killing is one that is fascinating, because it's all about earthbound production of carbon dioxide and methane, sound familiar, leading to acid rain and global warming, sounds familiar. And then the consequences of those on a large scale. And the point is, those things we know from modern volcanic eruptions or from modern coal-burning factories can have a local effect, the acid rain, the killing of trees, the local anoxia. If the eruption or other cause of production of greenhouse gases is large enough, and I don't think it matters, I think people would say, who think about these things, that it doesn't matter where the carbon dioxide or methane come from, whether they're from natural disasters or from man-made disasters. Nonetheless, once those gases get into the atmosphere, the way they are distributed, the effects they have on weather and climate and consequent effects on Well, today with the melting of the ice caps, we worry about that was not an issue in the Permo-Triassic. Obviously, there were no ice caps. But nonetheless, I think all of those elements of the model have resonances. And they've got to be handled with care because, of course, we can't then say if you release this amount of CO2 into the atmosphere as happened at the end of the Permian, this will be the consequences in terms of the loss of life, because it's not as simple as that for all those reasons I've mentioned. But nonetheless, often people, when they're having the discussion about current and future climate trends and what their impacts might be, they're often thinking only in terms of shortish timescales, like the human timescale back in time, or maybe back to the ice ages. And often they have to say, well, the best we can do is to run our computer models to predict what may or may not happen. This is not an experiment we can repeat. But of course, the geologists can say, well, actually, some of these things have happened in the past. And increasingly, we can be quite forensic by using isotopes and other observations. We can be quite forensic in determining the nature of atmospheres and movements of carbon and oxygen and the effects they have on living environments for organisms and indeed on the organisms themselves. So I can't give an exactly precise answer, but it's a case where if a climate modeler or other person has a question about what if, sometimes the geologist can say, well, here's a time that that happened, and we could spend a bit of effort to try to quantify what was going on and then use that knowledge of what the consequences were to sort of enrich our picture of what might happen in the future.
That's wonderful. I really wish there's some funding bodies listening to that.
Quite.
Well, Mike, thank you very much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soll, Liz Martin-Silverstone and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed at Paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.
I saw that you made corrections to my script.
I'm sorry, I can't stop myself.
Midway through, you're correcting typos.
Sorry, I'm a dyed-in-the-wool professor. I can't stop.
All right, okay. I even had your pen and you still managed to correct it.
That's all right.
Right.